The first time he leaned on me, it didn't feel dangerous. It felt human. A little desperate, maybe, but human. He was new, quiet in meetings, too eager to prove he belonged. I remember thinking, I know that look. I've worn it in other jobs, in other buildings, under different fluorescent lights. So, I made space for him. I explained the shortcuts no one teaches you. I translated the unspoken rules. I gave him the kind of attention that makes a workplace less cold. And for a while, it worked. Then his need started to get a shape. It stopped being occasional and became constant. If I didn't answer fast enough, he noticed. If I laughed with someone else, he watched. If I took a lunch break without him, he treated it like a betrayal. The day I realized my kindness had become a contract I never signed was the day he looked at me like I owed him oxygen. I was 32 when I took that job in Valencia, at a mid-sized logistics company that handled high-volume shipping for retail brands that wanted everything faster and cheaper. The building sat in a bland industrial park where every business looked like every other business, all gray walls and wide loading bays. All the same tired slogans about efficiency and excellence pasted on glass doors. Inside, it was a mix of old habits and new software. The company had grown too quickly, which meant half the systems were still held together by people's memory and favors. The other half lived in dashboards that management pretended were objective truth. If the numbers said it was fine, it was fine. If the numbers said it was failing, someone would be blamed. That was the culture. No one said it out loud, but everyone knew it. I worked in operations support, the space between the warehouse and the office, where the chaos of late pallets and missing scans got translated into emails with polite subject lines. My job was to keep everything moving without making anyone feel like they were failing. You learn how to do that. You learn to be calm when someone is shouting. You learn to phrase everything like a suggestion, even when it's a correction. You learn which managers want to be asked, and which managers want to be told they already decided. I'd been in enough workplaces to know that power doesn't always sit with the people whose names are on the org chart. Sometimes it sits with the person who knows how the system really works. Sometimes it sits with the person everyone goes to when they're panicking. Sometimes it sits with the person who can smooth things over before they become visible. In that office, for better or worse, I was becoming one of those people. It wasn't because I wanted to be important. It was because I didn't like mess, and I didn't like watching people get blamed for problems they didn't create. I hated the way mistakes turned into gossip. I hated the way silence became a weapon, so I did what I always did. I learned everything I could. I documented what I could. I answered questions. I helped. I became useful. And then he arrived. His name was Alvaro. He was the kind of handsome that doesn't announce itself. Not flashy, not arrogant. Dark hair kept a little too tidy. Clean shirts. A careful smile that felt like it had been rehearsed in the mirror on the way in. He looked like someone who had been told a lot in his life about being presentable. He had that tightness around the eyes people get when they are always bracing for judgment. He was hired as a junior coordinator, meant to assist with route scheduling and customer updates. It was the sort of job that was simple on paper and brutal in practice. The work moved in waves. Nothing happened for 40 minutes. Then everything happened at once. Drivers calling from the road, customer service forwarding angry emails, warehouse leads asking why a pallet wasn't where it was supposed to be. It was a job that made smart people look stupid if they hadn't been trained well. He hadn't been trained well. The first week I noticed him hovering at the edge of conversations, catching pieces of information without knowing how to ask for the rest. He took notes like his life depended on it. He stayed late. He apologized too much. He did that thing where he smiled when someone corrected him, like he was grateful for being embarrassed. That's the part that pulled at me, I think. Not the incompetence, but the discomfort. I've always had a soft spot for people who don't know the rules yet. I know what it's like to feel like the room is speaking a language you weren't taught. so I started helping him in small ways. The first time was an email draft. He had written a message to a client about a delayed shipment, and it was a mess of frantic explanations. He showed it to me with this strained expression, like he was bracing for me to laugh. I didn't. I rephrased it, kept it simple, gave him a structure. I told him to always lead with what the client needed to know, not what he needed to justify. He exhaled like I'd handed him a life jacket. After that, it became little questions. Where do I find this report? Who approves this change? Which warehouse lead is going to bite my head off if I call at the wrong time? I answered. I pointed him to people. I gave him context. He started seeking me out more. At first, it was flattering in a harmless way. Not romantic. Just that feeling of being the person someone trusts. I was good at my job, and here was proof. He'd walk over with his laptop open, eyes wide, and say he was sorry to bother me. He always said it like he meant it, like he hated meeting anyone. I told myself, it was fine, because it was work. I told myself, it was fine, because I'd rather he asked me than made a mistake that would get him torn apart by management. I told myself, it was fine, because I was the kind of colleague I wished I'd had. But the workplace doesn't let anything stay simple for long. Not when people are stressed. Not when someone's sense of safety attaches itself to another person. It started with timing. He'd message me early, before I even sat down. A little ping on Teams while I was still taking off my coat. Good morning. Are you in yet? Can I ask you something quick? The questions were always quick, but they were never quick. They came with screenshots, with voice notes, with a string of follow-ups that multiplied like he was trying to catch up on an entire career in a week. If I didn't answer immediately, he would send another message. Just checking. Sorry. I know you're busy. Then a third. I think I might have messed something up. Then a fourth. Please tell me if I should call the client. I'd look at my screen and feel that pull. That urgency. Like if I didn't respond, something terrible would happen. That's how it starts. A person's panic becomes your alarm system. The first time I set a boundary was almost accidental. I was in the middle of a meeting with my manager, Marta, going over a messy incident with a missing delivery scan. Alvaro messaged me 3 times in a row. The sound of the notifications made Marta glance at my laptop. Everything okay? She asked, and I could hear the subtle irritation that managers get when your attention drifts away from them. I turned notifications off. When the meeting ended, I saw a new message from Alvaro. Are you mad at me? It was such a strange question to receive from a coworker that my fingers paused over the keyboard. I reread it. Then I typed back. No. I was just in a meeting. He replied instantly. Oh, okay. I thought you were ignoring me. I told myself it was insecurity. New job nerves. I told myself it would settle as he gained confidence. It didn't settle. It grew. He started aligning his day around mine. If I went to the kitchen for coffee, he'd appear. If I went outside for air, he'd follow a few minutes later. Not every time, but enough that it began to feel like a pattern. The office was open plan, so you notice these things. You notice the same footsteps. You notice someone's head lifting when you stand up. You began asking personal questions that were wrapped in casual phrasing. Are you from Valencia originally? Do you live alone? Do you have a boyfriend? He asked it like he was making conversation, like it was normal office chatter, but there was an intensity to his attention that made those questions land differently. I answered carefully, the way you do when you don't want to create drama. I deflected. I smiled. I gave him small, safe facts. I didn't want to be rude. I didn't want to embarrass him. I didn't want to turn something awkward into something hostile. In workplaces, women learn very early that being cold can cost you. You get labeled difficult. You get frozen out. You get punished for not playing along. So I stayed warm. And he took that warmth as permission. He started calling me his anchor. That was the word he used. He said it one afternoon when we were dealing with a wave of delayed trucks because of an accident on the motorway. Everyone was frantic, phones ringing, managers asking for updates. Alvaro looked like he might dissolve. "You're my anchor," he said, voice low, like it was a confession. I laughed lightly because I didn't know what else to do. I said, "You'll be fine. It's just a busy day." He shook his head. "No, you don't understand. When you're here, I can breathe." Something about that sentence made my stomach tighten. It sounded too intimate for a Tuesday afternoon in a logistics office. It sounded like something you say to a partner, not a colleague. But he said it with such sincerity, such rawness, but it felt cruel to challenge it, so I let it pass. That's how people become trapped. Not with ropes, but with moments you don't address because they feel too heavy for the setting. Then came the first joke that wasn't a joke. We were in the kitchen, the office kind with a cheap coffee machine and a fridge full of forgotten yogurt. I was stirring sugar into my cup when Alvaro walked in and looked at me with that careful smile. "I don't like when you eat lunch with the others," he said. I blinked.
"What?"
He leaned against the counter, like he was teasing. "It's selfish. You know I don't have anyone else." I felt a flash of annoyance. It was subtle, but sharp. I hadn't invited him into my life. I hadn't made myself responsible for his social comfort. "I'm allowed to eat lunch with whoever," I said, still trying to keep it light. His smile tightened. "I know. I'm joking." But his eyes didn't joke. A day later, when I sat with a group from customer service, I felt his gaze from across the room. Not constant, not obvious. Just enough that I caught it and felt my skin prickle. That was the first time I started to feel watched. And once you feel watched, you start changing your behavior without even noticing. You take different routes to the kitchen. You delay standing up. You think twice before laughing too loudly. You keep your face neutral. You shrink. It's a quiet kind of theft, the way someone can take your ease from you while still smiling and saying all the right words. By the end of the second month, I had become his primary reference point. If he didn't understand a process, he came to me. If he had a mistake, he came to me. If he had a client complaint, he came to me. He came to me even when it wasn't my area. At first, I tried redirecting him. I'd say, "Ask Javier, he handles that." Or, "Marta can approve that." Or, "Check the SOP document." He'd nod, say okay, and then come back 5 minutes later with another question. Eventually, it felt easier to just answer. That's another trap. The path of least resistance becomes a habit. You stop fighting because you're tired. He began leaving little things on my desk. A pastry in the morning. A sticky note that said, "Thank you for always being kind." Once, a small keychain shaped like a ship, because we worked in shipping, and he thought it was funny. It was the kind of gesture that looks harmless from the outside. The kind of thing people would call sweet. If I mentioned it, someone might say, "Aw, he appreciates you." But appreciation has a line, and his gifts felt like claims. "I didn't take the pastry. I left it untouched." He noticed. "You didn't eat it," he said later, voice flat. "I wasn't hungry," I replied. He nodded slowly, like he was filing the information away. That was when I started to realize this wasn't simply a coworker needing guidance. This was a person building an expectation around me. A structure, a routine, a dependency. And the more he depended, the more entitled he felt to my attention. I've seen it before in other workplaces, in different forms. The person who needs you because they're overwhelmed. The person who attaches because you're stable. The person who confuses your professionalism for personal intimacy. It doesn't always end badly. But the warning sign is always the same. The moment your absence becomes an offense. The first time he made me feel unsafe, it wasn't loud. It wasn't traumatic. It wasn't the kind of moment people would point to later and say, "There, that's where it started." It was a look, It happened on a Friday afternoon. The kind of slow, exhausted Friday where the office feels like it's running on fumes. I had been answering emails for hours, my eyes dry from the screen. I stood up to stretch and saw Alvaro watching me from his desk. Not with admiration, not with friendliness, but with something possessive. Like I'd moved in a way that belonged to him. When our eyes met, he didn't look away. He smiled. And something in me went cold. That weekend, I thought about him more than I wanted to. Not because I liked him, because my body had registered something my mind was still trying to rationalize. I told myself I was overreacting. I told myself he was lonely. I told myself it would be cruel to punish someone for being needy. On Monday, he came in early again. He was waiting near my desk, like he'd been counting minutes. "You didn't answer me on Saturday," he said. I frowned. "You messaged me on Saturday?" He opened his phone and showed me a Teams message from Saturday night, around 11. A long text about how he felt lost, how he couldn't stop thinking about work, how he wished someone understood how hard it was. I felt heat rise in my neck. "Alvaro, I don't check work messages on the weekend." He looked at me like I'd slapped him. "But you're always online." "I'm not always online," I said, keeping my voice quiet because people were arriving. "I have a life." He blinked rapidly, eyes glossy, and then he laughed too loud. "Of course, sorry, I'm just... I thought you cared." That sentence landed like a hook in my chest, not because it made me feel guilty, but because it revealed how he saw our dynamic. Caring, to him, meant access. Caring meant availability. Caring meant being on call. I could feel the boundary line in the air, thin and trembling, and I knew if I didn't reinforce it now, it would disappear. So I did something I rarely do. I was direct. "I care about you as a coworker," I said, "but I'm not your support system outside of work." His face changed in a way I can still see. The softness drained. His jaw tightened. His eyes narrowed just slightly, like a person adjusting to pain by turning it into anger. Then he smiled again, too carefully. "Okay, I understand." He walked away. For the next hour, he didn't send a single message. He didn't come to my desk. He didn't ask for help. It should have been a relief. Instead, it felt like the air pressure changed in the room. When people like Alvaro withdraw suddenly, it's not peace. It's recalculation. By midday, the consequences began. Small, plausible, deniable. The kind of sabotage you can't prove. A client email that he was supposed to forward to me never arrived. I only found out when the client called asking why no one had responded. Alvaro acted confused. He said he thought someone else handled it. He said he must have missed it. Then a root update he had made in the system was wrong, and it created a ripple of delays that made the warehouse furious. When Marta asked what happened, Alvaro looked at me and said, calmly, "I asked her if it was okay." I stared at him. "No, you didn't." He lifted his shoulders slightly. "I did. You were busy." It was subtle. It was just enough to make me look unreliable without being obvious. If I argued too hard, I would look defensive. If I stayed quiet, I would look complicit. I learned long ago that workplaces love ambiguity. Ambiguity protects the system. It makes everything feel like a misunderstanding instead of a pattern. So I started documenting. Not in a dramatic way. Just notes to myself. Dates, times, messages, instances where he referenced me as an excuse. I didn't tell anyone yet. I wasn't ready to make it real. I wasn't ready to be the woman causing problems. Meanwhile, Alvaro began pushing again, but differently. He stopped asking for help directly. Instead, he created situations where I had to help. He'd send incomplete work, knowing I'd have to fix it to protect the team. He'd leave tasks unfinished so they landed on my desk. He'd CC me on panicked emails to clients, knowing my name would prompt someone to trust the response. He was forcing my involvement. And because I cared about the work, because I cared about not letting the place burn, I kept stepping in. Each time I did, I reinforced his belief that I belonged to him in some way, that my attention was his resource. Then he started framing my boundaries as cruelty. One afternoon, I ate lunch alone outside, sitting on a low wall near the parking lot. I needed air. I needed silence. I needed to not be anyone's anchor. He found me. He stood a few feet away, not sitting, just looming slightly in the sun. "You disappeared," he said. "I'm on break," I replied, keeping my voice neutral. He crossed his arms. "You didn't tell me." I looked up at him. "I don't need to tell you when I take lunch." His face tightened. "You used to." That was the sentence, the one that made everything clear. "Used to." As if my kindness had been a promise. As if my availability had been a standard I had now violated. "I used to because I was being nice," I said. "And I'm still nice. But you're acting like I owe you this." He laughed, but it sounded brittle. "I'm acting like you care." "I do care," I said, "but you're making it weird." His eyes flicked over my face, sharp. "Weird how?" The question was loaded. If I said, "You're being possessive," I'd be accusing him. If I said, "You're crossing boundaries," I'd be naming it. If I named it, I'd have to deal with what came next. So I did what so many women do. I softened it. "I just need space sometimes," I said. "That's normal." He stared at me for a long beat. Then he nodded slowly, like he was agreeing with a child. "Sure," he said. "Space." He walked away. That night, my work inbox filled with forwarded emails, all from him. Old threads, questions he could have resolved. He wasn't asking for help. He was flooding me, reminding me he could reach me, testing whether I would respond. I didn't. The next day, he started spreading something without saying it outright. I could feel it. The shift in how people looked at me, the way someone from customer service asked if I was okay with a too bright tone. The way a warehouse lead joked about me having a shadow. It was small. It was gossip's first whisper. The beginning of a narrative I hadn't agreed to be part of. In workplaces, a woman's reputation can be rewritten in a week. All it takes is someone suggesting there's something personal going on. People don't need proof. They just need a story that entertains them and explains their discomfort. "Alvaro didn't say, 'She's leading me on.' He didn't say, 'She's cold.' He didn't say, 'She thinks she's better than us.' He just behaved in a way that implied I mattered to him more than normal. He sighed when I spoke to other men. He hovered near my desk. He looked wounded when I didn't include him. He made it visible. And people noticed. Then he escalated in a way that made my skin crawl. It was a Wednesday. The office was loud, phones ringing, someone laughing too hard near the printer. I was focused on a shipping discrepancy when a message popped up from Olerol. 'I miss when it was just us.' I stared at the screen, my heart thudding once, hard. I typed back immediately, 'What do you mean?' He replied, 'You know, before you started avoiding me.' My fingers went cold. I could feel the boundary line shaking again, the urge to smooth it over. But I was tired. And I was angry. I wrote, 'This is work. Please keep it professional.' He didn't reply. 10 minutes later, he appeared at my desk. He leaned slightly, just enough that his voice could be low. 'You don't have to embarrass me,' he said. 'I didn't embarrass you,' I replied, keeping my face calm. 'You did,' he said, and there was something sharp beneath his controlled tone. 'You make me feel like I'm too much.' I looked up at him. 'Because you are being too much.' The words came out before I could soften them. They were honest, and they were necessary, and they were dangerous. His face went still. Not angry, not hurt, just blank. "You think you're special," he said quietly. The sentence felt like a switch flipping, not about me, but about him. Like he had decided something. "I think I'm allowed to breathe," I said, voice low. "That's all." He straightened, and the blankness shifted into a smile that didn't reach his eyes. "Okay," he said. "We'll do it your way." He walked away. That day, he stopped asking me questions entirely. And everything started going wrong. A report I had submitted was suddenly missing a critical attachment. Marta called me into her office, brows drawn. "This isn't like you," she said, tapping the email on her screen. I opened my sent folder and saw the attachment was there. But in the version she received, it was gone. That shouldn't have been possible. Unless someone forwarded it, copied it, manipulated. I didn't say that. Not yet. I just said I'd resend it. Then a client claimed they hadn't been informed of a delay, and Alvaro produced a message thread showing he had updated them. The timestamp was right. The email looked real. But when I checked the system logs, the update wasn't recorded. It was like he was creating reality on demand. And the worst part was how plausible it all was. Everyone knew systems glitched. Everyone knew mistakes happened. No one wanted to believe a quiet new guy would be petty or vindictive. No one wanted to believe a woman who had been helpful could suddenly be in conflict with someone. So the easiest explanation was that I was overwhelmed, that I was slipping, that I was distracted, that I was the problem. I started feeling the office turn slightly, like a tide. Subtle shifts, Marta asking me to double-check my work, coworkers being less warm, people not meeting my eyes. No one said anything explicit, but that was the point. Silence lets suspicion grow without accountability. I tried to keep my head down. I tried to be perfect. I tried to leave no openings. But you can't outwork a person who is determined to make you small. And then he made it physical. Just enough to cross into fear. It happened near the stairwell, the quiet space between floors where the sound of the office fades. I was carrying a stack of printed delivery confirmations down to archives, trying to get away from screens for 10 minutes. I heard footsteps behind me. I turned, and he was there, too close. "I'm not your enemy," he said. My throat tightened. "Move, Alvaro." He didn't. He stood in the narrow space like he owned it. "You don't have to shut me out," he said, voice low, intense. "I'm loyal. I'm the only one here who actually cares about you." I felt my body go rigid. The stairwell suddenly felt like a trap. No cameras, no witnesses, just concrete walls and his breathing. "I don't want this conversation," I said, keeping my voice steady. "Step aside." His eyes flicked over my face, hungry in a way that wasn't sexual, more like he was feeding on my attention. "You're shaking," he observed, almost pleased. "I'm not," I lied. He took one small step closer. I could smell his cologne, something clean and sharp. "You could make this easy," he said. "You could just stop fighting." The words were quiet, but they hit hard. Stop fighting. Like my boundaries were aggression. Like my breathing was a challenge. Something inside me snapped into clarity. This wasn't misunderstanding. This wasn't insecurity. This was control. I moved fast. I stepped around him, shoulder brushing past his arm. He didn't grab me, but he shifted in a way that made me feel his body pressing into my space, like a reminder that he could. When I got back to the office, my hands were trembling so badly, I had to hide them under my desk. I wanted to tell someone immediately. But I also knew what would happen. The questions. Why were you alone with him? Why didn't you say something earlier? Are you sure he meant it that way? Maybe he just has anxiety. Maybe he misread you. And then, the worst part. The way the workplace would become a courtroom, where my tone and my kindness were evidence against me. So I did the next safest thing. I withdrew. I stopped answering him. I avoided him. I moved my brakes. I kept my headphones on even when there was no audio. I made myself small, and he punished me for it. The thing about trying to quietly escape a person like that is you don't just leave them behind. You take their fingerprints with you. They stay on your routines, on your body, on your sense of safety. You start anticipating them in rooms they aren't even in. By the time I decided to report what was happening, I was already exhausted in a way that felt deeper than work fatigue. It was the kind of exhaustion that comes from being constantly alert, from scanning spaces, from choosing words like stepping stones, from living in a workday that felt like a long, careful negotiation. The breaking point wasn't the stairwell. It should have been. But fear can be survivable when you can still pretend it's isolated. The breaking point was when he made my combatants the battleground. It was a Friday again. Always Fridays with these stories. The end of the week, when everyone's patience is thin and the office wants clean narratives. A major client, one of the retail brands that paid enough to keep management sweating, had a shipment delayed due to a customs issue. It was a mess, layered with miscommunication between our company, the carrier, and the client's own team. We needed to respond fast. We needed to be accurate. One wrong message could cost us the account. Marcha called an impromptu meeting. Me, Alvaro, customer service, and a senior manager named Sergio, who rarely joined operational messes unless he smelled blood. He sat at the head of the table, with that practiced calm of men who never have to prove they belong. We went through the timeline. Emails, timestamps, logs. I had my notes. I had my records. I was ready to be clear. Then Alvaro spoke. He looked around the table with a controlled sadness and said, "I did what I was told. I asked her. She said it was fine." My stomach dropped. Sergio turned to me. "Did you approve this?" "No," I said, voice steady. "He didn't ask me." Alvaro's eyes flicked to mine. He looked wounded, almost betrayed. "Why are you doing this?" he asked softly, as if I were the one twisting reality. The room went quiet. In that quiet, I felt how easily my truth could be drowned. Because my truth required context, nuance, a story about boundaries and messages and discomfort. His truth was simple. He asked. I said yes. Now I was denying it. Sergio's expression tightened. "We don't have time for personal issues," he said, like he was bored. "We need facts." Personal issues. That phrase, tossed like a dismissal, made my hands clench under the table. It implied something. It cast a shadow over me. It made everyone in the room wonder if I was compromised. I took a breath. I said, "I have documentation." Marta's eyebrows lifted. "Documentation?" I pulled out my notebook. I didn't dramatic flip pages. I didn't perform. I just said, calmly, "I've been keeping a record of repeated incidents where Alvaro has referenced me, claimed I approved things I didn't, and contacted me outside of work hours. I asked him to keep things professional. Since then, there have been multiple instances of missing attachments, altered threads, and him implying responsibility falls on me." The words felt heavy in my mouth. Each one made it more real. Alvaro stared at me like I had betrayed him in the deepest way. His face reddened. His hands tightened. Sergio leaned back. "This is serious," he said. But his tone wasn't concerned for me. It was concerned for the company. Marta looked at me with something like shock and something like regret, as if she was seeing how long I'd been carrying it alone. Customer service avoided my eyes. Alvaro's voice went sharp. "She's lying," he said. "She's making me look crazy because she doesn't want people to know what she's like." There it was, the twist, the threat, the implication that there was something about me, some hidden truth he could reveal if he wanted to. My skin crawled. Marta ended the meeting abruptly. She told Alvaro to step out. She asked me to stay. When the door closed, she looked at me like she was trying to decide which version of reality was safer to believe. "Why didn't you tell me sooner?" she asked. I almost laughed, not because it was funny, because it was the most predictable question in the world. "Because I knew it would become this," I said. "Because I knew I'd have to justify why I was kind in the beginning." Marta's face softened slightly, and I saw something like guilt. "We need to handle this properly," she said. "HR." The word HR landed like cold metal. Not because HR is always useless, but because HR is built to protect the company first. And in a story like mine, protection can look like containment. Silence agreements, transfers, quiet exits, clean narratives. Still, I nodded. "Yes," I said. "HR." The HR meeting was exactly what you'd expect. A small room that smelled like stale air. A woman named Lucia with a careful voice and a notepad that made everything feel formal, but not necessarily safe. She asked me to recount the timeline. She asked if I had ever encouraged his attention. She asked if I had ever been alone with him. She asked if there was any romantic involvement. Each question felt like a test. Like the right answer could keep me credible and the wrong answer could ruin me. I told the truth. I said I had helped him professionally. I said he had crossed into personal territory. I said I had set boundaries. I said he had reacted with sabotage and intimidation. I described the stairwell moment without exaggeration, just the facts, the blocking, the pressure, the way he told me to stop fighting. Lucia's face remained neutral, but I could see her calculating. "Lucy." Then she interviewed Alvaro. I didn't hear the full details until later, but I learned enough. He said I was emotionally unstable. He said I was stressed. He said I had been close with him and then suddenly turned cold. He said he never blocked me, that he was trying to check on me because I seemed upset. He implied I had flirted. He implied I had made him feel special. He took my kindness and weaponized it. HR requested system logs. They reviewed email threads. They spoke to IT. And here's the part that still makes my throat tighten when I think about it. They found inconsistencies. Not enough for a dramatic confession. Not enough for a headline. But enough to show that files had been forwarded in unusual ways. That attachments had been removed and reattached. That certain messages had been sent at times he claimed he hadn't been online. They couldn't prove everything. But they proved enough to make management nervous. The result was not justice. Not exactly. It was corporate safety. Alvaro was moved. Not fired. Not publicly confronted. Not named. He was transferred to a different site outside the city. Framed as a development opportunity. The company avoided a scandal. The org chart stayed clean. When I heard that, I felt two emotions at once, relief and rage. Relief, because I could breathe again without feeling watched. Rage because you got to leave as if he was advancing, and because everyone around me got to pretend it was handled. After his transfer, the office became quieter around me. People didn't gossip anymore, not openly. They acted like nothing had happened. Like the whole thing was a misunderstanding that had been resolved. But the residue stayed. I noticed how certain coworkers stopped coming to me for casual chat. How some men looked at me with a slightly different expression, like they were reevaluating me. Like the story had planted doubt they couldn't shake. And then there were the ones who tried to comfort me in ways that made it worse. A woman from customer service, Anna, pulled me aside and said, "At least it's over. He was just intense. Just intense." A warehouse lead joked, "Don't adopt any more strays, eh?" I smiled tightly and walked away. They thought they were being light. They didn't realize how those comments reframed everything. Like I was responsible for his behavior. Because I helped him at the beginning. Like I had adopted him. Like my professionalism had been a choice that invited risk. It took weeks for my body to stop flinching when someone appeared behind me unexpectedly. It took months for me to stop checking stairwells before entering. I started timing my breaks differently out of habit, even though he was gone. That's what people like him do. They don't just create a problem. They change your internal geography. They make you map safety in places that used to be neutral. The final blow came quietly. One afternoon, Marta called me into her office again. Her expression was cautious, rehearsed. "We're restructuring," she said. "Operations support is being redistributed. Some responsibilities will shift." I listened, already sensing where it was going. She said, "We're moving you to a role that's less exposed." Less exposed. Like my competence was a vulnerability. Like my presence in that space had become a liability because of what happened. I stared at her. "Is this because of Alvaro?" Marta sighed. "It's not about him. It's about preventing future complications." Future complications. That's how workplaces bury truths. They turn harm into complications. They treat your boundaries like risk factors. I felt heat rise behind my eyes, but I didn't cry. I'd learned not to. Tears become another kind of evidence. "I don't want to be moved," I said. Marta's face hardened slightly. "This is what's best for the team. For the team. Always the team. Always the system. Always the smooth surface." I walked out of her office and sat at my desk, staring at the screen. I realized something then, with a clarity that hurt. Even when you report, even when you document, even when you survive the obvious danger, the workplace can still punish you for being the place where the truth became visible. Alvaro didn't get to keep controlling me directly anymore. But the shadow of him had changed how the company saw me, how it treated me, how it positioned me. I took the transfer anyway, because fighting it would have required energy I no longer had. I moved into a quieter role, more administrative, less central. My days became calmer on the surface, but something in me stayed tense. Months later, I saw him once, not in the office, in a cafe near the Central Market. I was picking up bread on a Saturday morning, hair pulled back, trying to be anonymous in my own city. He was sitting outside with a coffee, alone. When he saw me, his face lit up like he'd been waiting for this moment. He stood. My body reacted before my mind did. My pulse spiked. My hands went cold. The street suddenly felt narrow. He walked toward me, smiling. I didn't stop. I didn't greet him. I didn't pretend. I kept walking. As I passed, he said softly, "You never said goodbye." I kept moving. Behind me, I heard him laugh under his breath, like I was being dramatic, like I was proving his narrative about me. When I got home, I locked my door and leaned against it, breathing hard. Not because he had touched me, not because he had shouted, because even once later, he could still pull my nervous system like a string. That's what dependence looks like when it turns into pressure. It isn't always a grand explosion. Sometimes it's a slow tightening around your life. A quiet claiming, a steady erosion of your ease. People talk about love like it's a warm thing, like it's safety. But in workplaces, the thing that looks like love can be the oldest form of control there is. And it always starts the same way. A person needs you. And you don't realize that need has teeth until you try to step back and breathe.